is Alex Walsham, and I'm one of the organisers of this event, together with Kate Peters and Lisbeth Corrins. And first of all, we'd like to welcome you to the British Academy, and thank you all for coming. Our speakers, our chairs, and the many people who've expressed interest in this conference. Quite remarkably, 2 months before the event was due to take place, we already had fully booked, and there were apparently as many as 50 people on the waiting list at some point. So we're extremely pleased that this has attracted so much interest and attention. Just want to say something briefly about the aims of this conference. We want to focus over the next 2 days on the surge of record keeping between 1500 and 1800. And we bring together historians, literary scholars and archivists to consider the creation, preservation, management and use of records and of archives, to look at the relationship between record keeping and the historical transformations that have defined the early modern period itself, religious, political, cultural and intellectual and economic. So the connection between this set of developments in record keeping and the Renaissance, Reformation, new modes of scientific inquiry, state formation, capitalism, overseas expansion, the advent of print, the spread of literacy and education, and burgeoning bureaucracy and advances in technology. Thirdly, in this conference, we want to foster and encourage critical reflection on the ways in which these developments have shaped and constrained historical knowledge itself. So our aim is to explore how, quite literally, archives make history and how they construct and skew our vision of the past. So I'm now going to turn over to Kate to...
Thank you. It's my job, really, to... thank you all for coming, and to highlight the scope of the conference, which has grown since we started imagining it. In fact, I found a file on my computer last night that talked about it as being European record keeping in the early modern world. And this is a conference which we're really pleased encompasses British record keeping, European and global perspectives on record keeping. So thank you all very much for the contributions that you will make to such a broad span of papers. And I have to say, as for myself, I'm really excited that this is a conference that includes archivists and historians and literary scholars in the same room. And I'm very much looking forward to the dialogue between those professions and to see how we can support each other's endeavours, really, and bring scholarship forward. So we've had a lot of support and enthusiasm from contributors and participants at the conference. The other thing that has been slightly overwhelming is the amount of support we have had from sponsors. Obviously, we're very lucky and grateful to be able to hold this in the British Academy. Some of us are slightly overwhelmed and a little bit freaked out as well, but it's a wonderful venue. And we're particularly grateful to British Academy staff, Penny Collins, James Rivington and Jessica Warner, who have done all of the organising. So I personally take no credit for any of that, but the British Academy staff has been immensely helpful. We've also had funding support from a number of other bodies, the Society for Renaissance Studies, or an acronym called CRASH, which I now call it, it's the Centre for Research in Arts and Social Science and Humanities Research based in Cambridge. We've had funding from the Royal Historical Society and also from Past and Present. So a really broad range of institutions have supported us. We're immensely grateful to that because it has enabled us to hold this here in central London. Okay, I'll hand over now to Lisbeth.
Okay, welcome from me as well. And again, wonderful to see so many people. And we hope very much that many of you will continue this evening as well during the public event that is at 6 till 7:30. That will be that will be open to many others as well, but we hope that you stay and continue that discussion. After that discussion, there is the the reception, to which you are more than welcome. So that would be great to see all of you again. In terms of other drinks arrangements, as you've all seen, there is coffee and tea here just outside this door. And for lunch, we will let you go free. But that is, if you, there is a lot of things around here. But if you walk into Piccadilly Tube Station, there will be everything you would want. In other news, there is a hashtag. So anyone who's on Twitter, please use that hashtag so we don't keep the conversation within these walls. It would be great to keep to get more people involved as well. So thank you.
Okay, well, we now turn over to our first session, and I'm going to hand over to the chair of that session, Professor Hamish Scott. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And we've got three speakers who've been at the forefront of research on archives and information management in the early modern period. The first speaker is Randolph Head, who's professor at UC Riverside. He's an authority in early modern Switzerland, and he's currently completing a comparative study of archives in early modern Europe. Professor Head.
Good morning. Good morning. It's a particular honor and a challenge to be the first speaker here this morning. And I do want to begin again by thanking Alex Walsham, Kate Peters, and Lisbeth Correns, with whom I've been corresponding for a long time now, since they launched this conference. It's very exciting to be here. The speakers are people who I've wanted to hear for a very long time, many of them, so I'm really looking forward to that. What I'd like to do today is to draw from my own current project, which I'll explain just a bit in a moment, by using two exemplary cases. To describe two exemplary cases of the kind of material that I've been studying, with two goals in mind. One is to frame out the range of possibilities of new kinds of record keeping that were emerging around 1500, building very much on European medieval precedents and practices. One can't speak of a sudden sharp break by any means, but at the same time, doing new things and reaching new kinds of practices that were emerging because of changes in how governance worked, because of changes in the materials available, the staff available, and the practices found in European archives in particular. I really work in the heart of the beast in the political archives of larger states as a whole, so we'll really be looking at sort of the core venue, perhaps, of one kind of record keeping, one tradition of record keeping that was evolving rapidly at this time. But the other thing I'd like to do, at least to sketch out, is the importance of a comparative dimension, not only for understanding the European case, but equally by comparing two non-European cases, by provincializing the European tradition and putting it into a fruitful relationship with other modes and means and traditions of record keeping around the world. I think we will benefit both our own work within Europe, for those of us who are European historians, but also advance this growing field or sub-discipline of the history of knowledge or the history of information in ways that I think are absolutely essential. So I have an inward comparative dimension and an outward comparative dimension that I will try to illustrate through these two particular archival products. And I'd like to start really with a historiographical moment, going back to one of the first great comparative analytic works, Ernst Posner's Archives of the Ancient World, which came out in 1972. And in the opening chapter of this bold and path-breaking study, Posner directly addressed a critical question. A book on the history of ancient archives, he wrote, must justify its existence, which meant to him, among other things, establishing that the wide range of records or textual objects that he proposed to survey did in fact constitute archives. The book, after all, is called Archives in the Ancient World. And he responded to this imperative with a move that I think we must both respect and critique. He asserted, and I quote again here, "We find in the ancient world already those basic types of records that may be called constants in record creation." Unquote. These constants he defined in terms, and I put sort of sketched them out for you here directly from his book, that derive transparently from the European understanding of what archives are and what they're for and how they might be used. And indeed, from the archival science of his own Prussian and Germanic formation as a young man before he came to the United States, where he worked at the National Archives. Laws of the land, records of past administrative action, records securing income, notarial records, and so forth. These are familiar categories, and we can respect his need to have a framework of categories to address the vast range of material from cuneiform tablets to Roman wax tablets that he was confronting. But we also need to confront this categorization or this approach critically. We've learned over the past generations that we need to ask very carefully, where is the line between identifying constants and projecting our own assumptions? And one of my own current, my current agenda, something I'm very excited about, is the feeling that we need comparative studies that do not make Posner's assumptions about the constants of record keeping. These were necessary for him, but they're now ripe for reconsideration. And it's essential that we place the European trajectory of record keeping, and I think there is such a thing, very much in the context as one among many that took place around the world in a global early modern period, if we can speak of this. So my goal today is an inward comparison to show some of the distinctions and differences among archival products around 1500, a little bit after, thus breaking up a unitary sense that there was a homogenous and straightforward European tradition of archiving in the heart of states, and at the same time pivoting outwards to emphasize that there is a single conceptual vocabulary which frames around these different European examples, and that's a vocabulary, an approach, a perspective that we can provincialize and differentiate rather than projecting it outwards as Posner did, as he had to do, as constants in record creation or as any universal law of the archive. My own work in particular has approached this material by looking at finding aids, at inventories, at the various ranges of things we might call metadata, which I find to be particularly useful because they always constitute representations of the records found in a repository. A finding aid has to know what it finds, and it has to represent that in a new and accessible form to imagined or real users. And thus, these kind of products reveal something about the purposes that their makers understood records to have and about the practices they followed in the circulation, the creation, the use, the keeping such records. Finding aids and the organization of archives are one critical element of archives as practice in larger context. Finally, quickly, a brief word about the two cases that I'll read these sections that I'll be talking about today. They're both in the form of books. One of my sort of surprise finds over the last few years has been how absolutely central the codex was to early modern European archival administration. They were in archives, and they were about archives, but took the form of the codex. Both were products, conscious products, of rearranging material that was already there. These are finding aids that refer to and point to often very large and very untractable corpora of recorded information. And both are different. They're very different responses to the challenge of too many records, of difficulty, challenge of loss that their makers confronted. And yet, they're both the same. They're both not only in the form of a codex, but they use tools from the little tools of knowledge, the mise en page, all the way up to their assumptions about what it means to demonstrate, what it means to prove, what it means to know, that are very much out of the European tradition of dominion. So they're similar, and they're different, and that's the ground on which comparative work, I think, flourish. There we go. The first one I want to talk about is the Lettura Nuova, a collection of some 60 copybooks produced in Lisbon between 1504 and the early 1560s, when it trailed out for lack of money. And on the illuminated frontispieces of this series of fine parchment volumes in the Torre de Tombo archive in Lisbon, King Manuel I ordered the inscription of the following command. "And so that one may find the necessary items for those who may need them with greater certainty and less labor, we order that you organize the aforementioned torre and its writs with great diligence. And after they have been organized and harmonized, we in order that those that might be necessary at some future time be newly copied and written truly, the lettura nova, the new reading of the material in the archives. With these words, repeated on the frontispiece of volume after volume, the king initiated an extraordinary project. Known then as now as the lettura nova, with some 60 volumes, 200 to 300 parchment leaves each, before running out of steam in the 1550s. The lettura nova represents a high point of a century of intensifying organization and the production of new chancellery books in Lisbon, which also included newly copied chronicles and legislative compilations. The project is revealing because of its particular combination of administrative conservatism and material sumptuousness, both characteristics that correlated with Portuguese royal politics and culture at the time. Although Portugal experienced tumultuous change in the late 15th century, the crown enjoyed an unusually central position in the governance of the realm, reinforced through its crusading history the incorporation of the powerful military orders. Portugal's growing overseas empire enriched the crown, making the royal court the hub for all political matters without transforming the metropolitan political order. These circumstances found a strong echo in record-keeping practices, which concentrated on structures of privilege when dealing with Portugal itself. Portugal's kings issued numerous privileges and writs that their chancellery recorded in dense parchment registers. And these are the primitive registers from the mid-15th century from the Torre de Tombo. Both the acts themselves and their tracking reinforced the centrality of growing royal power, and thus Manuel I's decision to create a permanent, authorized, and splendid treasury of royal deeds in book form reflected political reality, as well as the monarch's ambitions and self-regard. The lettura nova volumes that the chancellery began producing differed sharply from the chancellery's primitive registers, as you can see. Not only were the lettura nova volumes sumptuous and beautifully made, they also formed an organized corpus according to a comprehensive scheme laid out in the king's mandate. On the following pages behind that frontispiece, it lays out in detail how this whole system is to work. There's a new archival gaze at work, one might say. As was common in late medieval repositories, the lettura nova divided its textual space into sections with a different ordering principle for each. One part was ordered geographically, another oriented to political actors and their actions. 47 of the 60 volumes corresponded to the comarcas, the territorial divisions of the royal administration, while 19 volumes tracked spheres of interest of the king, such as royal relations with the military orders, legitimations of nobles, and other acts of royal grace. Now, the royal mandate appears on these illuminated frontispieces on 28 of the completed volumes, and the frontispieces were painted for subsequent volumes for later kings, so they didn't fill it in yet, so the new kings could put their own mandate or update the mandate there, and those were never finished. The entire series served to prove, in the legal as well as the public sense, the lasting validity of royal acts through their material re-representation, authenticated by the direct command and participation of the current monarch. Thus, the king actually reviewed the copies, along with the licenciados who had reviewed the copies against the original record, personally signed the first three volumes to be completed of this series. Thus we see an ongoing project to preserve the deeds of the monarchs of Portugal in a permanent and ceremonially representative form, in parallel with those primitive registers which continue to be produced. King Manuel's close personal attention to the lettura nova corresponds to one of its primary features, namely the great efforts taken to authenticate each volume and indeed each individual leaf. Lettura nova established that the records on its pages were authentic and public, not only by illumination and decoration, by the perfection of the parchment and the layout and the rich bindings, but also by the mise en page found on every page. Here's back to the illuminated title pages I got behind my slide, sorry. The mise en page helped authenticate by having at the bottom of nearly every page, several thousand leaves, the supervising notary and secretary placed his signet at the bottom of the column, so nothing could be added. In its content, this remarkable project was a selective register. It drew records of emitted charters, emitted acts or deeds of the king from a wide variety of sources, primitive registers, loose documents and other sources, and put them all together in a new arrangement, a new reading that made them permanent and stable for the future, at least so their makers hoped. Considerable effort and careful searching preceded the actual production, and detailed tables of contents identified the recipients. And the tables of contents are also gorgeously produced on parchment, rubricated, and in beautiful script. The project's opulence, the great work undertaken with other records, and the fact that it was conceived as an ongoing project distinguished La Torre Nova from most late medieval and early modern issuance registers. Every indication suggests that the collection was understood as a treasure, akin to, but more elaborated than a cartellary. And in this respect, the La Torre Nova stands at the end of a medieval tradition of preserving authentic records to fulfill a probative imperative. So this is one end of the spectrum of codex form finding aids shortly after 1500. Meanwhile, contemporaneously, but pretty far to the northeast, a quite different set of chancery books was emerging in Würzburg, the Prince-Bishopric of Würzburg in Franconia, through the labors of a certain Lorenz Fries. From 1520 until his death in 1550, Fries labored among the Prince-Bishop's holdings of records, document, and codex form, and ultimately produced a series of interlocking finding tools that provided effective access to very diverse material. In contrast to La Torre Nova's focus on representing proofs, Fries created a codex-based method to extract knowledge about the Prince-Bishopric and its affairs from its repositories. His interest in the contents of the Prince-Bishop's trove is documented by the extensive marginal comments that Fries left throughout the corpus, which served both his historical researches and his comprehensive guide to the useful knowledge that the records contained. The earliest phase of his lifelong effort to create a usable knowledge repository took place in the Marienberg, across the river from the city, where a large vaulted room in the castle contained five cases full of loose documents. And this is a widely disseminated image of the watercolor representations of those cases that Fries produced. It's quite interesting how rare this kind of representation is. It's a very effective way to label and to make accessible these cases, yet very few archivists thought to do it in this particular way. By about 1530, Fries had made a visual guide to the cases, drawers, and their labels, as well as an overview that he described as, quote, a common register arranged alphabetically about the above-mentioned cases and what rests in each box with an indication of the box's number and row. So he's finding ways to characterize and describe what's kept in this remarkable case. During the same years, the Würzburg Chancellery also formed or reformed a number of series of chancellery books in order to bring together relevant records on specific topics. A whole wave of rebinding and recopying of older materials, this is very typical of the early to mid-16th century, as well as the launching of many new series, left the Würzburg Chancellery with 349 chancellery books in 61 series, these representing a key operational resource for the future. Fries added comments about the function and importance of each series as he put them together, often with added notes about its development. For the series of office books, the Amtsbuch, he observed that, quote, the older bishops did not use a separate book for this. Rather, their officers were appointed in the fiscal chamber, and therefore thereafter taken under obligation by the chapter. This kind of comment suggests he was not simply spelling out what kind of transactions are found, but actually giving a brief history in the beginning of each of these volumes of these chancery series. But I want to turn now to his magnum opus, something called nowadays called the Hohe Registratur, the High Registry, which was a comprehensive three-volume guide to the entire system, books, cases, series, one that pointed to records about the bishop's possessions, to their interests and responsibilities as secular administrators. Some of the pointers referred to the cases and drawers in the Marienberg, others to the volumes in the 61 series of books. In each volume, this alphabetical series had entries for places, for people, and for subjects, such as pharmacy, preceded by a table of contents and oversights of the material. And this is quite different from the La Torre Nova. It's on paper, there's no illumination. However, in interestingly, there was a parchment presentation copy made, which unfortunately was destroyed in a fire in 1572. So what we have is really the final draft on paper, which remained a key operating resource for this chancellery for the next two centuries. It was really a very usable kind of thing. Just to take an example, this example does not correspond to this page because the digitization hasn't gotten as far as the letter E, which is where my notes are based on. But for for a completely random hamlet, Lower Oerdorf, for example, Fries writes, concerning the See of Würzburg's privileges there, Konrad von Hutten, then office holder for the district of Trimsberg, at some point carried out an investigation, and the documents lie bound together at the palace in the chest on contracts under the letter A. So once again, rather than simply giving a brief reference, Fries explains as well as locating documents. And these explanations often expanded into systematic essays of 2, 3, 4 more pages. The Hohe Registratur thus served multiple functions for the episcopal officers who had access to it. It was a finding aid, to be sure, for those in search of specific documents. You needed that investigation in Oerstdorf, you knew where to go. But the summary guides to cases and book series could also guide a clerk who needed to browse in a particular genre of record. Where are the contracts? Where are this sort of thing? Where is that sort of thing? And someone who needed simply information about a specific village, lord, corporation, or profession could use the alphabetical headwords in the table of contents to locate both a brief introduction to the material and pointers to the relevant records. Working through the Hohe Registratur's pages even allowed it to serve as a kind of gazetteer encyclopedia, certainly not its primary task, but not insignificant for training, for ongoing consciousness of this system of knowledge that it embodied. Thus, in its combination of flexibility and comprehensiveness, Fries's Hohe Registratur was indeed quite distinctive for the early 16th century. It was a carefully designed knowledge tool, part of a larger system, and deployable for multiple purposes. And here we see the other end, essentially, of a spectrum of possibilities contained within the covers of a chancellery book. So these large, conscious codex form products share the conceptual and material substrate while directed at different ends from different standpoints. Lettura Nova sought to represent proofs in the service of patrimonial authority, commanded by an active monarch who had much larger resources than his predecessors and who had wanted to deploy his powers to contain traditional noble patrimonial rivals while building up an imperial overseas project. The Würzburg Hohe Registratur enabled the mobilization of political knowledge as a heterogeneous category. It emerged out of the work of a series of reformed prince bishops who invested heavily in new staff and resources. And it emerged in a region characterized by complex entanglements that required several levels of knowledge to understand proofs, privilege, and power in that context. So, stepping back a bit to the larger project, comparison inwards, comparison outwards. In comparison, comparative approaches in the human sciences always mean that delicate balancing between similarity and difference. The Lettura Nova and the Hohe Registratur are interestingly different products of archival processes that were reviving or growing in intensity around 1500, seen from a European comparative perspective. But they both embody shared discourses of proof, knowledge, and representation that make them similar and thus comparable. They are manifestations, I would argue, of an identifiable cultural form, the European political archive, when looked at in this inwards way. But we could also project their shared elements outwards, as Posner does, universalizing these characteristics. But what if we contrasted these shared elements with their parallels in Chinese or Islamic or pre-Columbian record-making and record-keeping? We could look at discursive foundations, understandings of power and governance, of public and private, all of the various specific habitus of the text and the codex, from scripts to mise en livre to mise en page, all the things that leave traces of records and documents. And I can't tell you, or I can't report on the usefulness of such an effort, because it has scarcely been tried so far. Rather, I'd like to urge us to use the range of assumptions that emerge from intra-European comparisons to highlight the contingency of Posner's constants and provide us an opening that might allow such comparisons to be useful. Thank you very much.
Society of Jesus in the early modern period, and if you've gone into your welcome pack, you will see he's just published a book last September on the birth of the archives and history of knowledge.
Thank you very much. You'll let me know after 20 minutes. Okay. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you very much to the conveners for having me. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here and to share some very preliminary results of an ongoing research that I'm currently conducting. This research focuses on the many small to medium-sized feudal archives of rural France, especially but not exclusively those of the nobility, mostly during the 18th century. Many of these archives were, for long stretches of the early modern period, in bad or even dismal shape. Sources speak of leaking roofs, papers on the floor, and frequently mention documents in total disarray and without any order. In the following minutes, I want to sketch very briefly why and how this started to change in the 18th century. I argue that this change was largely the work of the so-called feudistes, which could be loosely defined as experts for archives and record management. They were called upon by nobles, ecclesiastics, and in general by French seigneurs of all kind to improve the archival status quo. During the 18th century, there must have been hundreds or more likely even thousands of these feudistes in towns and cities all over France. While there were many, only few of them left personal papers, and those are usually only very fragmentary. I've explored quite a few archives départementales over the last years trying to piece together what can be found out about this very specific archival culture, which is centered on the provincial areas of France. To me, the feudistes are interesting, however, not just in themselves, but because they might provide one tiny bit of an answer to a very large question. The question is, how did it happen that sometimes between the Middle Ages and now, archives as technologies of knowledge management were not only developed and established in certain advanced contexts, say, administrative centers, but eventually enveloped an entire society, that of Western Europe? Just as the history of the book about a generation ago started to turn into a social history, the emerging history of archives, I think, might also benefit from such an additional perspective. We too should ask how archives and archive-related practices spread, how record-keeping became habitualized on a broad societal scale, and how archives started to penetrate even the most remote rural areas. The feudistes are relevant, I think, for such a social history of archives because, as I hope to demonstrate now, they were instrumental in turning local culture archival, as the title of my presentation says, or claims at least. Now, if a person was known as feudistes to the contemporaries, this indicated several things. It meant, in the first place, quite straightforward and simple, that this was a person with paleographic experience, a rare and generally extremely uncommon, highly specialized capability in early modern France, where actually only few people were able to read medieval or 16th century handwriting. Accessing ancient documents was thus a very difficult task. Quote, "Our abbess does not know our documents and cannot consult them," as a nun from the Abbey of Nyonzeau explained when the feudiste Aubin from Augère was hired to do exactly what the abbess could not do. Furthermore, a feudiste would be assumed to be capable of searching for and ideally also finding such feudal documents wherever they might be. A feudiste was thus someone who knew how to work in and with archives. He would know the documentary repositories in the region, and this was precisely his appeal, so this was precisely why he was such a prominent figure. Finally, and this is something I do not want to go into today, it's just a different topic, feudistes were frequently also working as surveyors and produced maps of seigneurial landholdings, but this is not what I'm talking about today. These feudistes were very practical people. They were practitioners. They might have some university training, but the more important part of their expertise, their archival know-how, as we might call it, was typically acquired in something akin to apprenticeships. Well-established feudistes, such as, for instance, Auguste Laprie in Angers, or one Guillaume Roussel in Tours, over the years trained and educated several feudistes of the next generation. So it was learning as you worked with some experienced feudistes that you grew into the métier. Frequently also the archival know-how was passed on within families, and I'll just spare you all the details of fathers training sons and uncles training nephews here. Most of these feudistes came from the lower middle classes, yet their group included the occasional odd nobleman. Some of them, for instance, the Abbé Verger from Tarbes in southern France, acquired actually very prominent social status even in Versailles, yet most of these people lived much more or quite humble lives out in the province. A typical fédiste resided in a provincial town or village and was well known to the public. People knew who they were and where to find them. The fédistes, I would think, were part of the professional class, offering their services to whoever might need and pay for them. Archival expertise, it seems, in the 18th century had become part of a self-sustaining service industry. This implied that the fédistes were continuously trying to solicit new jobs and offered their services to pretty much everyone. They were frequently and very actively pitching projects to potential employers, whether by classified ads in local newspapers or by working their social networks. Both of these things are well documented. Usually, all of this happened on a regional and local level, and this is where I'm trying to get at, but at least occasionally these fédistes tried at least to connect themselves to national institutions too, occasionally. Some of them, to give you just an example, for instance, approached Nicolas Moreau, the royal information broker of the 1760s, and touted their archival experience to him, although with not very great success. Making a living from archival work was thus quite possible for the fédistes, yet it required some capabilities in dealing with patrons and potential clients. You needed to be business savvy, so to say, to actually make money out of your archival expertise. Some of the fédistes were quite successful with this and ended up with large offices, often employing several, sometimes even dozens of people helping them do their work. With all of this, I argue, archival work became part of the professional and social landscape, even of provincial towns. Even modest seigneurs in rural France now had access to pretty sophisticated know-how in document management. The fédistes, in other words, brought advanced care for records and a sophisticated culture of archival expertise even to remote areas of Europe's most popular kingdom. If the fédistes and their expertise became, as I think, a fixture of rural and provincial France, this was because they satisfied a growing demand that they then in turn tried to increase, of course. Seigneurs of all kind, but especially noblemen, were more and more willing to invest in their archives and to hire fédistes for at least two reasons. Archives, as people came to understand in the 18th century, improved feudal management, and archives became all important for genealogy. Feudal management and genealogy were the two major projects that made the French seigneur in general and the nobility in particular turn towards archives. And it was the fédistes who were hired to achieve this during the 18th century. Thus, they ended up, as I've titled my talk, turning rural French society archival. Let's discuss these two broad areas quickly. And let's begin with feudal management. French historians, as most of you probably know, have long debated if and when something like a feudal reaction, a tightening of seigneurial exploitation and an aggravation of the peasantry's economic burden happened in the decades before 1789 and might even have contributed to the revolution happening. Now, whether or not the feudal reaction actually occurred is highly contested. There can be, in my mind, no doubt, however, that a closely connected, and this is my term, archival reaction did indeed take place. What can be said for sure is that more and more seigneurs actively reorganized their archives in order to support their own position vis-a-vis their tenants. Seigneurs knew about their titles and contracts, and they were threatening tenants with this knowledge. The Marquis de Marigny, for instance, brother of the Pompadour, in early 1774 ordered Jean-Luc Rocher, who worked as fédiste for him, quote, to put a certain Monsieur Lédé in his place, for he deserves no mercy from me. I told him to produce a document supporting his position. Since he cannot do so, I will push my rights. Marigny felt sure of himself in this battle, in this combat, as the sources call these confrontations over and over again. Marigny felt sure of himself in this battle because of his vastly superior knowledge about documents that he had gained by employing fédistes such as Rocher. Indeed, fédistes, just like this guy Rocher, did frequently execute extensive archival research on behalf of their employers. Even minor seigneurs would expect their fédistes to consult several archives, often relatively distant ones, to support their claim. One fédiste in the Bordelais region was hired in 1754, for instance, to, quote, extract all important documents of our archive and of all other archives pertaining to our interest. Accordingly, the Fidists often spent many days visiting archives, checking documents, verifying information, and so on. And I have a long list of examples here about which Fidists spent how many days in which archive. I won't read that, but I guess you get what I'm trying to say. The Fidists' archival knowledge was thus often linked to an itinerant lifestyle. They were nomadic archivists or nomadic archive users. Moreover, the Fidists would call upon their colleagues for help, often by correspondence. A certain Fidist named Ducop, working on behalf of the Seigneur du Poncet, the seigneuries north of Tours, wrote letters in 1770 and 1772, for instance, to several archive holders in the area requiring information and documents regarding his lord's relationship with his tenants. Thus, fairly systematic searches for relevant feudal archival materials executed by experienced archive users equipped with superb reading skills became a routine feature of 18th century feudal management. The bits and pieces of surviving evidence concerning this aspect thus clearly document the Fidists' archival versatility. The Fidists, and this is important, the Fidists, contrary to what the tenants could do, never tired in their perusal of archive. Over the years, they acquired a superb and, I would argue, largely unmatched knowledge of which documents lay where in their region. They would know, for instance, which notaries had worked where for how long and who owned the old registers now. They would know what happened to a family's papers once a family branch, say, had died out or the family had moved elsewhere. They would, through lifelong experience, travel and correspondence, turn isolated landscapes into connected deposits. In short, to them, rural France looked like a landscape of documentation, to paraphrase Paolo Camarosano, a landscape that could and had to be read as a coherent and integrated whole. Sort of the archives have to be seen not as isolated spots, but as a sort of a coherent whole, a landscape of documentation. The Fidists were probably not the only ones who turned the myriad of individual archives into such a coherent whole. Think of the Benedictine monks who traveled around and knew about archives too. But I would think only with the Fidists, this sort of integration of the archival space of France really acquired a widespread social traction. Let's now turn to the second field of the Fidists' activity, genealogy, which is a field I'm very much interested lately, and I can only sketch this here very, very briefly. At least since the 15th century, the French nobility had been subjected to periodical evaluations of the kings. You probably know all that. Special deputies were sent out to do, as it was called, researches of nobility, recherche de la noblesse. This time-honored practice acquired a new urgency under Louis XIV and Colbert, not least for fiscal reasons, a long story very briefly told here. Proper documentation of noble status was in the 18th century also required more and more regularly to obtain charges at court. In sum, so-called proofs of knowledge, as the dossiers of relevant titles and documents were tellingly called, proofs of nobility, this is what the documents were called in the end, became a fixture of noble life and culture during this time. While this development has attracted considerable attention from social historians, its important implications for the history of European archival culture, I believe, have not been recognized yet. The constant pressure on the nobility to prove their status according to more and more demanding documentary criteria forced the nobility to acknowledge that archives were a key infrastructure for their struggle to support their social status. Now, no wonder in rural France it was the Fidist who would be employed to do this work. I've seen much, indeed huge amounts of evidence of provincial nobles honestly trying to make genealogical sense of their archives themselves. A letter of the Comte de Lupé from 1764 from southern France, for instance, makes it quite possible to imagine this minor member of the Second Estate sitting on a large deck surrounded by documents reconstructing by himself sort of his ancestry. He did indeed know quite a bit about his forebears. He knew about distant relations in the 15th and 16th century, so he was very much personally involved in all this. Yet, he ultimately felt helpless. He needed support. A letter was written to the Abbé de Verger in Tarbes, and Lupé also in that letter mentioned that he had requested help from a certain Jean-Baptiste Larcher, both of them living in Tarbes in southern France. Verger and Larcher are among the best examples of Fideists with a special expertise and a special knack for regional genealogy. While, and I want to stress this, while most Fideists were in one way or another, on one occasion or another, involved in proofs of nobility, some of them, like Verger and Larger, made this their predominant activity. From both of them, Larger and Verger survived tens or probably even hundreds of thousands of pages of genealogical notes in the southern French archives. All of this knowledge, this is important today, all of this knowledge stemmed directly from archival evidence, often referenced in very specific and very superb detail. So they would actually tell you which lias to go to if you wanted to find the document that they were just referencing. What these Fidis, like Larger or Verger, provided was usually very specific and very targeted genealogical knowledge. Their language reflected this. Archives were mined, for instance, to, quote, make your genealogy go back beyond 1400, meaning towards 1300, making the genealogy be more impressive, or to provide, quote, again, a connection between two individuals that once supposed were related, but one couldn't prove it yet. This was not erudite reconstruction of provincial history, although this might be a byproduct occasionally. This was also, I would argue, not glorification of a family towards a general public, as in the printed genealogies of the 17th and early 18th century happened. Rather, this was archival research with very specific purposes. Quote, my nephew is about to become Zuleutnant in the Royal Regiment, unquote. And thus, the noble status of his family had to be proved, as one nobleman wrote to a Fidist who he employed to come up with the proofs so that his nephew could actually get this charge at court. This was the kind of knowledge that these Fidists provided for the noblemen, and this, I think, is the second reason why archives and the Fidists as a group became so important for these rural provincial cultures in 18th century France. Time is fleeting, so I'll be very brief in the end. So far, I've highlighted to you that the Fidists, in my opinion, had a great importance for what one could call a regional or maybe even local archival culture of 18th century France. So this is really what I want to stress. It's a local, a regional, a provincial, if you want, archival culture. But I do want to mention also that the Fidists, or at least some of them, had a broader and more general influence too. And I want to make three points very briefly in the end to illustrate this. First, one of the major tasks, and one could say one of the lasting historical accomplishments of the Fidists, was often to arrange the seigneurial archives and make them ready for future usage in the first place. Much of the documentation that we still have today, and much of the finding aids and organization, actually goes back to these 18th century people. So this is a very substantial, long-lasting influence, I would say. They laid the groundwork of archival organization that in some respect can still be seen today. They were often hired to organize, to order archives. They were hired to produce inventories that are still around today, and I'll just cut the details here. My second point why these Fidists have a long-lasting influence goes in a very different direction. Some of the Fidists turned their lifelong practical archival experience into textbooks that they published in print. I would argue that most of the printed discourse on archives in France before 1789 was actually authored by these Fidists or came from the feudal milieu. The governmental, administrative, or legal literature on archives, for instance, quite prominent in Germany, did, as far as I can see, have no parallel in French discourse. These books provided how-to-do information. It was very practical for reading documents and organizing chaotic archives. They often implied even specific tips for how to do this, for instance, how to draw up a contract with your future employer so you don't get screwed over, basically. Sorry, my language. It was this highly practical literature that carried on into the 19th century and was still used in the 19th century archival education. And this is my third point. Indeed, the Fidists connect pre-revolutionary French archives to the Napoleonic, to the revolutionary, Napoleonic, and even the Restoration era archival culture. A long topic. The Revolution did create the national and departmental archives, as we all know, yet it usually failed to educate the necessary staff. Thus, pre-revolutionary manpower and pre-revolutionary know-how remained crucial. Indeed, not only large numbers of secularized Benedictines, but, and this is my point obviously, also very many Fidists found employment in the lower and middle ranks of the evolving revolutionary and, if they lived long enough, post-revolutionary archives, and there is a huge number of people who actually stayed on throughout this archival turmoil. Clearly, the Fideists, with their paleographic expertise, archive-related experience, and their published literature, were among the relatively few experts one could turn to, even for the most basic services, at least before the École Nationale des Chartes was founded. Thus, and this is my final remark, the Ancien Régime cast a very long shadow on French archival culture. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me. Ludovico Antonio Muratori is the Italian epitome of the 18th century transition from antiquarianism to source-based history. From 1723 onwards, he published a total of 25 volumes of annotated medieval sources in the Rerum Italicarum Scriptoris, a series that was to become a model for the Monumenta Germania Historica in the 19th century and is still ongoing today under the aegis of the Istituto Italiano Storico per il Medioevo. As head librarian and archivist of the Dukes of Modena, Muratori was himself in charge of considerable records stretching back to the 14th century. Under the leadership of Francesco III, he oversaw the attempt to reunite the Este collections then badly scattered in different cities. In a work dedicated in 1740 to Francesco III, Muratori explained the main historical cause of that dispersal, the most traumatic event in the history of the Este Duchy, the devolution of Ferrara back to the Holy See when the dynasty's main line became extinct in 1598. The ensuing treaty left the cadet line of the family their estates in Ferrara, but assigned sovereignty to the Pope. It also detailed how resources were to be divided. Half of the artillery was to go to each side, for example. Instead, the family was to bring most of the archive to their new capital, while the papacy would retain those records which related to the administration of the newly acquired city. As Muratori recounted in a literal variation of the classical trope of the letters and the arms, on 16 January 1598, the two sides met in Ferrara to split carefully both the writings and the guns. In this brief passage, Muratori for a moment turned from the archive as source to the archive as object, in a move that, to some extent, prefigures the more recent archival turn that we've all been commenting on today. Most cited in this trend is Ann Stoller's work on Dutch colonial empires. I'll come back to it at the end of my paper. Here I want to mention two lines of scholarship that are less known in the English-speaking academic world. Working on very different archives, the French medievalists of the Nouvelle Érudition have all emphasized how textual preservation can be as meaningful as textual production. Meanwhile, Italian Renaissance scholars have been showing how record making, and to a lesser extent record keeping, reflected new features of state building in the 15th century. This storia documentaria delle istituzioni, which may remind some in the audience of Geoffrey Elton, derived from Federico Chabot's work of the 1950s on the Italian Renaissance state. But it has recently inspired new research, summed up in the volume edited by Isabella Lazzarini and Andrea Gamberini for Cambridge University Press in 2013. These developments are extremely welcome, and they are relevant for most of us here today. Personally, I believe that they need to be developed further by asking questions of two sorts. And here I think there is a convergence between the paper you've just heard and mine. Questions of two sorts, which I'll try to address today. The first is whether we can apply these insights to the early modern period. The second is how to adopt a more inclusive approach. Because it turns a source into a question, the archival turn shares many features with the history of the book a generation ago. But if we are to be as successful as book historians, we need to include a socially wide variety of actors and a range of possibilities beyond smooth institutional functioning and state building to misuse and conflict. These are some of the questions I've been asking while working with two postdoctoral fellows and two PhD students on a project on the history of archives in late medieval and early modern Italy. The project is funded by the ERC, and I gratefully acknowledge their support. Italy is a wonderful terrain field for this study. The country was at the forefront in the institutionalization of large-scale record-keeping. Some archives are still stored in their original locations, as in Turin and the Vatican. And even where this isn't the case, they're housed almost invariably in impressive buildings like the Franciscan Convent in Venice. This gives researchers a very visual sense of the records as embedded in an old and enduring history. But this is not to indulge in a dream of linearity or continuity. In fact, doing the history of archives presupposes the greatest break of all, when the Risorgimento put an end to the old states and stripped archives almost overnight of their current use for administration in the 19th century. This turned archives into sites of scholarship. It also meant that, with few exceptions, post-unification archivists preserved the papers in the order in which they had inherited them. Finally, then, Italy's archives are not just rich, they're also incredibly diverse. Anyone who's done research in more than one Archivio di Stato knows that arrangements vary wildly. Combined with the lack of central repositories before 1861, this has made them often seem puzzling to early modern historians. Yet these diversities make it possible to ask comparative questions. In the Archives Project, we focus on seven case studies distributed along the peninsula to redress a traditional northerly imbalance in the history of the country. For each case study, we ask similar questions relating to six broad themes: the politics of archives, the organization and material arrangements of the records, the social characteristics of the staff, the use of archives by outsiders, and in particular by historians. The range of the themes shows that we are determined, to try at least, to embed the history of institutions in an inclusive and broad social and cultural context. What then were the main developments in Italian record-keeping practices in the early modern period? I want to concentrate on two phases, roughly coinciding with the classical periods known as the Rinascimento in the 15th century and the Prima Età Moderna in the 16th and 17th century. The long 15th century saw several broad changes in record-keeping practices amounting to what I may a bit ambitiously describe today as an archival renaissance. First of all, as Isabella Lazzarini and Francesco Senatore have shown, the territorial expansion of oligarchic republics in some cities and of princely dynasties in others coincided with the production of new genres of documents. To put it briefly, medieval communes regularly produced beautifully decorated statues and capitula, which, in a bit of the kind of tradition that Randi was referring to earlier on, and these codices transcribed or summed up the rights of communes at a time when those rights were called into question by higher powers, such as the emperor. These volumes remind one of monastic cartularies, and as Attilio Bartoli Langeli put it, were meant to be archives unto themselves, or book archives. From the late 14th century, we see a transition from Urkunden to Akten, as new genres of documents began to be preserved in continuous series which arose from the daily practice of administration. For example, growing bodies of diplomatic correspondence and libri officiorum were held not as legal proofs of old rights, but as sources of information about the current state of the city, its territory, and foreign relations. And they were regularly consulted in the production legislation, as we know from plentiful marginal annotations. Secondly, governments passed the earliest measures for the preservation of records, and they appointed the first staff specifically devoted to looking after rather than producing the records. Archivists also prepared the first inventories, and there was a physical shift from treasures of documents held in churches to new buildings. First came Republican cities like Florence with the new Palazzo dei Priori and Venice with the Ducal Palace. New resources also made it possible to specialize record-making offices, as with Leonardo Bruni's famous reform of the Florentine Chancery, divided in 1437 into Prima and Seconda Cancelleria for the composition of respectively external and internal letters, and with the exactly contemporary separation of the ducal and secret chanceries in Venice, which you see in the slide here. Moving from papers to people, this period also saw the emergence of large bureaucratic apparatuses. In essence, medieval record making was dominated by notaries who served crucial functions because communes needed them to give legally recognized validity to their transactions. Instead, the 15th century was the great age of secretaries, as both republics and principalities increasingly availed themselves of experts lacking the credentials of notaries, but knowledgeable about the governmental machinery. These are relatively well-known features. To them, I would like to add two more. The first concerns the geographical scope of archival innovation. While most works concentrate on northern and central towns, we should add the importance of the southern kingdoms. In particular, the Aragonese expansion introduced complex documentary instruments for long-distance government and also made it possible to concentrate record-making offices, first in the Palazzo Steri in Palermo, which you see here, and then in Naples in the Sommaria. The final and even less known element of the archival Renaissance has to do with the introduction of new features even in old documentary genres. Archival registers were enriched with paratexts, such as tables of contents and alphabetical indexes, and separate indexes of indexes were also produced. These were no longer topographical inventories listing the contents of archives cabinet by cabinet. They were retrieving tools meant to help secretaries find relevant bits of information subject by subject. We know that their preparation was extremely time-consuming, but chanceries could now avail themselves of greater manpower and clearly felt that the documents had so multiplied in numbers that they required new techniques for information management. The second phase I will call the Ancien Archive Régime. It opened with the invasions and wars of the early 1500s and with the regime changes that those wars brought about. The 16th and 17th centuries saw some significant changes in archival practices too. There are many aspects I could touch upon here, such as the novel use of archives by historians, the composition of the first treatises of archival science, the greater use of Italian in record making, the growing presence of printed documents and forms in archives, and others. I want to emphasize four. First, the 16th and 17th centuries saw an explosion in document production, as is obvious to anyone who set foot in an Archivio di Stato. These figures are just examples. The different offices in charge of diplomatic correspondence in Republican Florence have left us, this is the first graph, then less than 300 volumes for the period up to 1532. This pales in comparison with the Grand Ducal correspondence, which amounts to some 2,300 files for the following 200 years. One could say that much of the same early correspondence went missing, of course, but we find the same remarkable inquiries in series that run continuously and have been preserved in their entirety, and so can be assessed over a long period. These two Venetian series, second graph, respectively relate to foreign policy, the Secreti, and to city administration, Terra. The number of registers produced every year increased respectively 6 and 12 fold between the 16th and 17th century. Secondly, growth doesn't just imply increased production. It reflects a greater emphasis on preservation. This resulted in the provision of enlarged storage capacities. To an extent unheard before, archivists complained in the 16th century about the massive increase in documents using worried images like rising sea tides of papers and wieldy machineries and so on. They succeeded in obtaining funds for more capacious furniture, new rooms, and eventually self-standing buildings, which significantly extended storage capacities. The Venetian Secret Chancery grew from 11 cupboards in 1546 to 75 in 1669. In Palermo in 1627, the Senate's archive was given a new extension. And by the end of the century, the Savoy dynasty was planning a whole new building. Finished by Filippo Juvara in 1731, it was the first, I think, to be designed specifically for accommodating an archive. A third change signaled a shift in archival mentality, namely the first serious separation of record making and record keeping. Until then, most of the papers other than charters were kept at the back of the same rooms in which they were produced. In the 16th century, it became common to transfer documents from running archives into deposits, which were now, for the first time, described with the word archivio. In some cities, this resulted from government change. Nowhere is this clearer than in Florence, where the new Medici dukes ordered the old Republican documents inventoried and locked up in the Archivio delle Riformagioni. When they moved court into the new Palazzo Pitti across the Arno, their secretaries kept the documents they needed for everyday business in the new palace, but regularly brought papers non più utili, so no longer useful, to the Palazzo Vecchio, as it now became known. Sometimes they did so through Vasari's specially designed corridor, which you see here. The same separation took place where there was political continuity, probably because of simple space issues. In Ferrara, administrative offices regularly transferred papers in a special Archivio della Grotta. As the name implies, this was out of the way, and so documents became less accessible. By then, though, they were also less useful. The Grotta, too, in turn, suffered from space limitation. By 1580, the archivist calculated that the average annual intake was 30 boxes of papers and asked for an annex to be built. The final transformation I want to touch on was the attempted centralization of both public and private records. This led, for example, to the establishment of central repositories from the archives of dead notaries, pioneered in Bologna and Venice in the 14th century, but renewed in Florence in 1569, Naples 1604, Rome 1625, and Modena 1634. Centralization also involved the request by governments of the official papers held privately by the families of former ministers and ambassadors long after their death. As the Archivario of the Sommaria of Naples complained in mid-17th century, important officials kept documents relating to their office at home, as if everyone could make for themselves an archive. As he explained, this meant exposing important papers to all sorts of accident, from theft to fire. But the point is a more general one, and we also find it in treatises and legislation at the time, which increasingly describe jus archivi, or the right to have and run and establish an archive, as the prerogative of the sovereign. To sum up, the records increase and consequent extension of archival facilities, their subdivision and centralization, all point to a growth in the archival consciousness of early modern Italian authorities. So far, I have described these changes as if implemented from the center outwards and from the top down. But the point to stress is that each of them was the result of competition and itself engendered more contention. The government's attempt to recall public records from retired ambassadors clashed with the proprietorial attitudes of noble families to their papers, and for this reason eventually failed. In a coda to my paper, then, I would like to touch belatedly upon the other element of my title, conflict. First, conflict could be carried out through archives, which were systematically used by governments in the pursuit of disputes with neighbors, whether to claim precedence or to establish boundaries. There was a name for this, bella diplomatica, wars made with charters, which became increasingly common at a time when more traditional warfare ceased. Reversing Clausewitz, one could say that the result of the military weakness of early modern Italian states was that politics became the continuation of war by other means, particularly by means of plentiful publications of archival documents, which in turn fostered political debate, further political debate. Secondly, conflict took place not just between, but inside states, around archives, because rival factions and groups tried to access reserved information or compete with their own archive and information. For example, in 1628, a Venetian senator searched for precedents to support a controversial proposal against the oligarchic Council of Ten. At first, the Ten prohibited the senator from entering the archive. When he managed to obtain that right, the archivists themselves hindered him, saying that the papers could not be located. And so he recounted that in the end he had to climb a ladder himself to fetch the right volume. Such frictions led to a veritable proliferation in leaks and to a black market for archival information, which again fed political discussions outside the governmental palace. The point is that central archives didn't exist in a vacuum. All around them thrived other and competing centers of record keeping. Alongside the new Medici archive in Florence, other families had rich collections in which they tried to preserve, and this is an example still surviving today, in which they tried to preserve traces of the city's republican and their own patrician past in a politically charged mixture of erudition and nostalgia. Thirdly, inside archives, we see, if not conflict, then at least disagreement and some hidden traces of contestation. Record keepers are normally seen as just that, keepers, anonymous guardians of the memory of their superiors. In Venice, unlike, for example, in Lisbon, they were forbidden from adding personal signatures or marks to the records. Yet their presence can be detected between the lines and in the margins of official registers. Some scribbled words and images in government registers revealing a playful approach to official acts, which they clearly regarded as their own stuff. Occasionally, they gave graphical expression to discontent or scorn, as in this doodle inscribed in the 1455 decree, which reduced the salary of patrician officers. This was a time when chancery secretaries had already seen repeated cuts. The secretary instructed to copy the pay cut of his superiors couldn't resist drawing a big grin inside the decree's initial. Finally, conflict focused on or against archives too. This is too big a matter to approach here, but many revolts throughout the early modern period, as in Naples in 1647 and again in 1701, targeted archives and destroyed collections, not just of tax records, which had an obvious practical function, but also old chancery registers, which had a much more symbolic and political importance. We're back to the guns and writings with which I started. Only this time, the violence is directed not from inside the archives out, but from the outside against the archive. Archives were powerful instruments of government, there is no doubt, but they were also fragile, ridden with tensions and open to competition. So to conclude, in the words of Anne Stoller, the archival turn from archives as source to archives as object is about reading archives along the grain. I think that's fine, but if the archival turn is to tell something about history beyond the presumptions of rulers, as this conference shows it will, we have to read archives not just along the grain, but also against it, to study how archival practices interacted with a messy social and political reality which they could only ever hope to order on a metaphorical level alone. Thank you.
question for all three of you, but I just wanted to pin down the actual term archive, and more so, I think, in France, because I know that when Colbert is creating his archives through violent methods in which people are actually killed and there are uprisings, he does call those either, he calls them bibliothèque and papier. And in fact, when he does that, and this sort of gets to Marcus's point, he is thinking in a very mercantile way, that this is a sort of competition, and for him to dominate this competition over information, to dominate trade in many cases, or taxation in the case of the nobility, he'll have to dominate these papers, and he does that by a bibliothèque. I'm wondering when it becomes an archive, and of course Filippo shows that the Italians, who really, I think, become in many ways the innovators of the archives, at least when they bring architects in Torino, and they start creating actually an archivio that's next to the library. I'm wondering sort of when this happens and when conceptually that moment of the archive arrives and might be different in different places.
Right, just gathering my thoughts. Well, I think there is the reason why Colbert may have called his archive and some other archives bibliothèque is that he was there, and we have very many similar examples in Italy, collecting the sort of the best of political and commercial economic knowledge, as you show very well, in his library. This is very different from, I think, from the birth of archives as sort of running deposits where current records are regularly deposited. It seems to me that, the word archivio has been around for a very long time. There are also very different etymological origins that all kind of trace back to antiquity. It seems to me that in Italy, certainly, and I'll pass on, the distinction between the increased use of the word archivio in the administrative language is from the 15th and especially the 16th century onwards, where some rooms are really designed to store old records which are no longer for immediate purposes.
Just a few scattered thoughts on that. It's a very rich question, of course. And much of what we today call archives, what we all three have been talking about today, would not consistently have been called an archivio, archivum, whatever, at the time. I have been going sort of through a 10-year process of narrowing my concept of the archive and really taking it back to its high medieval and late medieval roots as treasury. When we talk about archives, it's treasuries. And it's treasuries that are not for daily use. I think Filippo's exactly right there. But they're treasuries that are still very, very valuable. There's a lovely example that's been discussed by Jean Potin, among others, in France, that when they made the inventories of the Trésor de Chartres, it is exactly contemporary and exactly parallel to the inventory that is being produced for the adjacent Trésor of Jewels. And actually, the Treasury of Jewels is more detailed. The inventory is more careful in the 1380s in France. So I think that we do well. There's all sorts of repositories, and I think record keeping is this broad, rich concept. And the greatest precision will emerge if we narrow the concept of archives to that combination of treasure, authority, authenticity that distinguishes that kind of a repository from the extremely heterogeneous, rich collection. So Colbert would never have thought it was a treasury. It is exactly a collection.
I just want to make three very quick points. First, these noble archives are called many things, Chartier, whatever. Very often they are called archive. The one thing they are never called is bibliothèque. So I've not come across any reference where the fidist would actually work in the bibliothèque of a nobleman. I've not come across it. I'm happy to take the reference. Well, Osier is not the fidist. He's sort of the central thing, which it's a central archive, but it's not the archive sort of the FIDIS would deal with. Dossier sort of is an interesting point because this, I would say, is the only conflict or point of conflict in which the FIDIS are involved. So there is nothing about they protecting the archive from sort of official ingression or something. The only thing they fight with is, of course, Dossier and the Bureau if they would not want to accept the proofs that the noble had submitted. So this is the only line of contact of conflict. Colbert, I would say, third point, is indeed important. I would speculate that Colbert and his sort of information gathering actually drove home the point to the nobility. And I would also speculate, this is not hard to, not easy to prove, but I would speculate that some of the people that might have been working with Colbert were sort of becoming the first Fidists. But this is sort of speculation right now.
Lady in the third row, and then the gentleman in the front row.
Thank you. I have a question for Dr. Friedrich. My name is Joana Garmendia from the National Archives. When you mentioned the Fetish and how they were helping the French nobility to do certain research into their own genealogy in order to assert certain rights and privileges, I was wondering whether an element of that proof of nobility was purity of blood, the fact that they had not had a Jew ancestry. I'm asking this because of the rich collection on one of the Spanish royal chancery archives where precisely the nobility had to prove that they had purity of blood. So.
Well, thank you very much. The term, as far as I know, does not show up, and there is, as far as I have come across it, nothing which compares to the Spanish case where Moriscos or Jewish origins would play a role. They are, of course, very concerned if they detect non-noble family members. So this, of course, is what it's all about. But I have not come across anything which would indicate Jewish or Muslim ancestry, even in the southern French regions that I've studied, which actually are close to Spain and sort of have cross border connection, so I've not come across this.
Gentleman in the front row.
Hello. I'd like to supplement the question would be the previous question concerning the emergence of mercantilism in European cities and towns during this period.
Possibly speak up a little, I don't
think. Ah, sorry. Yes, I'd like to supplement the question of the previous question concerning the emergence of mercantilism in the European cities and towns during this period as feudalism began to be replaced by the next economic stage of development of capitalism. Mercantilism was mainly an urban phenomenon rather than a rural phenomenon, and as the Mesopotamians, the inventors of writing first, as demonstrated, writing was a particular urban phenomenon. Does the emergence of mercantilism correlate with the proliferation of record keeping in the 15th century?
Well, I would say the stuff I have looked at, there is not much of mercantilism sort of directly coming up. This is about feudal relations. We should also, I think, understand that these feudists were not the people who were responsible for managing the estates. So if you're looking for, let's say, improvement of agriculture, improvement of water technology and so on and so forth, this would not be the feudists who do this. This would be the intendant, for instance, who would then sort of hire a fidist to do very specific archival work. So in the material I've been looking at, this archival component, I see mainly these old sort of feudal connections that are worked over and over again. But others might have.
Well, I wanted to, in a sense, expand your question, because I think you've touched on an elephant in the room. And Jake Saul is the great authority on this right now, on the importance of financial records, whether they be mercantile or state financial records or individual family financial records. I think that financial record keeping stood in a constant dynamic relationship with the record keeping that is archival in the sense of state and power and domain based. And there are periods of intense interaction, and I think there are periods when they diverge, and when they follow their own paths, and then they recoalesce. So we can say, I think in the 14th century, late 13th century, is a period, I know this from Innsbruck, but I think it's probably true everywhere, where the people
keeping the archival, the charters, are actually learning their indexing and registering techniques from the fiscal record keepers. But then for two centuries, they diverge, so that by the late 15th century, they literally alphabetize differently, which suggests they're not exchanging personnel. And then you get these coalescences where the two, and mercantilism, I think of England, of course, John Brewer's work, where financial record keeping becomes constitutive of ideas about record keeping in general again. So I think it's a back and forth rather than a continuous relationship, but it's an enormously important one. And because old financial records are insanely difficult to study, they are neglected.
Can I just briefly follow up to say that, in fact, I suspect that if you were to count papers, leaves, you'd find out that the overwhelming majority of papers in both private family archives and large state archives do derive from financial and especially fiscal supervision. And certainly as far as Italy is concerned, the earliest, much before mercantilism, the earliest archives were those of the Camere, which were is a sort of common name to describe fiscal tax revenue offices in cities as early as the 14th century.
Gentleman in the back row, and can you identify yourself?
Certainly. It's Warren Boucher from Queen Mary. My question is also about terminology. And the word I heard in at least two of the papers, I'm not sure if I heard it in Marx's, was the word that is most commonly used in the late medieval and early modern period for a record, which is a register. Registro in Latin, registro in French, libro registro in Italian. And I wonder if that word is a very important one, and understanding the transformations in what is meant by a register is just as important as understanding whatever the term for an archive might have been. I have in mind, for example, that a register could be a roll originally, but it more commonly became a book in the 16th century, a book in which you recopied records for specific purposes. So it's a question about the importance of the term register.
Well, the term register and the reality that this is, again, my sort of gut-level feeling, I'm not sure I can attach evidence to it, that most or much of the work in late medieval and early modern chancelleries of various kinds was done in registers, and that the loose document, the individual charter, the individual deed, which was issued to a recipient, terribly important through the central Middle Ages, terribly important in the monastic tradition, although, of course, then incorporated for working purposes into a register of a specific type, the cartulary. The term is very broad. The term register is very broad, as you say. It's used for emissions registers most narrowly, but it's used for, certainly in the 16th century in the German space and in Spain, I think, certainly in the German space, it's used for all sorts of books. A register of something, and it can be copies, it can be correspondence, it can be internal, but it's a collection, it's a gathering, possibly on a roll, certainly after the 15th century, almost certainly in a codex, and I'm following my colleague Simon Teuscher here from Zurich, that those registers increasingly are put together. The mise en page and the mise en livre are shaped with tools of scholastic knowledge. And you find that in the terminology that they use, articuli numeri, and so forth. So it's an ubiquitous process of creating these books, and that the work of record keeping and record management and record using primarily happens, not exclusively, of course, but primarily happens in those registers. So the history of early modern archives, just to say it in a much exaggerated way, is the history of archival books. But that may be too strong.
If I may come in, because actually in Italy the situation is slightly different. So registers, the word registro is used very commonly, was used very commonly at the time to define two very different things. One was the sort of the kind of running. Is ledger the word in English? The running. I agree with Randy. The codex is crucial in archives. So. Yes, but there are two different things. One is the running book where you register or record transactions or events of various kinds. The other is transcription in neat, how do you say, bella copy, neat copy in Venice, for example, on parchment. So with an intention, the intention there is durability. That is also a register, but the loose documents are also kept alongside the register. Both these activities are called, there is not just the word registro, there is also the word registrare. And so, but this has two very different meanings. One is more sort of every day-to-day administration. The other is more sort of historical and, you know, looks at long-term use.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you. Megan Williams, University of Groningen in the Netherlands. I'm working on a project myself at the moment, looking at the role of paper in the intensification of diplomatic practices in the early modern period, and also in the archiving of this correspondence, and wonder whether we can connect what the shifts which Filippo and Randy and also Marcus to a certain extent for a later period discussed in the intensification of archiving practices to the intensification of paper usage, particularly since financial records, for example, were one of the first realms in which we see the use of paper in the early modern period.
Well, it's one of those points that seems compelling, but I don't know how we would prove it. You certainly see a transition from parchment records, whether loose or bound and rolled, bound and so forth, about with the emergence of paper for reasons that are fairly obvious. I think you would be the one who could tell us that. The other thing that I think seems to be happening at the same time, and again, whether we can prove a connection or simply observe a parallel, is the use of vernacular. So, you know, you go from Latin parchment limited record keeping to paper vernacular extensive record keeping. And it's awfully tempting to say that somehow these are connected. But I think that's something we need to look for and think of ways to test that proposition. I was struck by the extensive use of parchment in Lisbon. And I went to Paul Sanger at the Newbery, where I was working at the time, the Newbery Library, who was a great paleographer and codicologist. And I said, was parchment cheaper in Iberia because they had lots of sheep? And he said, no, he didn't think so. I was like, maybe they're using parchment here because it's just relatively, the price difference isn't as big. I don't know. And I think we need to find out.
The only point I want to make is that, as I mentioned in my previous intervention, in some cases parchment did continue to have a very long life. In Venice, they kept using it, and in the Republic, well, collapsed in 1797. But in 1797, they were still registering on parchment the records up to 1795. So on parchment, and this is as late as the end of the 18th century. And in fact, there is various quotations, but there is one by a secretary who says, you know, unless I can't remember it now, but properly, but unless we register on parchment, these things will become unusable within a few decades. He has this kind of, you know, long term consciousness already.
I just want to come back to Randy's point about the vernacular sort of as being a parallel with the paper thing. Something that is very obvious in the sources is that people not only had a hard time reading ancient handwriting, but they also had a hard time reading sort of medieval Latin. This is sort of extremely obvious to anyone who studies archive. They could simply not understand the legal abbreviations. Duconge was a great success, therefore, and I can find it in many Fidis sort of like, you know, footnotes. Oh, Duconge says, thankfully, that this term means this and that. So I support your point about the vernacular and the paper sort of being connected, and this breaks sort of an older tradition, almost not completely off, but sort of this is a kind of a new era in many ways.
I have to tell an archive story. In the early 18th century in Zurich, I think it was Johann Jakob Uran and his daughter produced a 50 or 30 or 70 volume set of copies of old charters and documents, precisely to get over this problem. The Latin document, the early or the Middle High German, Mittelhochdeutsch documents, they of course translated into modern 18th century German, and the Latin documents they translated and copied into French.
Well, I think that provides a very good point to end. We've had a splendid first session, but can you join with me?